July, June 20th? Did we say it was? The same date as the other side. Easier that way. Now, I guess we left off after the Walken, battle at the Walken Causeway, and we're getting into Nijmegen. After you captured the island, wasn't it an island, Walken Island?
Yes, we didn't capture it. We attacked the island, and the British came in after that from the land. They came in from the seaside with British Marine Commandos, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and I've forgotten whether what the British unit that was that attacked, eventually, mm-hmm. we were able to secure that area.
Mm-hmm.
But our part, the Canadian attack, or the, in particular my own regimental attack, was in many ways the worst disaster that
mm-hmm.
the battalion encountered mm-hmm. in the whole of the war. Mm-hmm.
And we're just alluding to it off the tape that there is a school of thought which suggests that the whole thing was, well, ill-conceived and poorly planned and that type of...
Well, once we got out there, we knew we were going to have to take it, but the fact that they waited
mm-hmm.
so long, there was a sort of a feeling, once they took Antwerp,
mm-hmm.
that you fell back into the trap of thinking, well, that's it, it's practically over, we'll finish it by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And this did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did was give the Germans time to consolidate that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the people that I've read about it would suggest that it was a mistake. We should have just really kept driving on and not worried about it. Once we had cleared the port of Antwerp, we left that to
mm-hmm.
somebody else to deal with. And before the Germans could get their breath
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
go in there and clear the approaches to the harbor,
mm-hmm.
all of that shelter.
Because, mm-hmm. of course, once you... what principle of warfare is once you have them on the run, you keep them on the run.
Hopefully, that's what you're trying to do. But immediately, of course, when that happened, I don't know the big picture. All I know is things that I have read about it,
mm-hmm.
and it would appear that Patton was screaming for he wanted to go for broke, and Montgomery wanted this, and Eisenhower backed away for
mm-hmm.
a while, and we just sat and didn't really.
Mm-hmm.
Take advantage of the fact that we had taken this port, and boy, we needed supplies. We were pretty strung out, and we were taking supplies still from the original beachhead.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long way
to move
the amount of supplies that were needed to keep an army going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That one you mentioned that people may are beginning to think that perhaps the war might be over at Christmas. Was there ever a feeling of people beginning to think, well, I'm not going to be the last one that's going to be killed in this war?
Not at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It began to, I think, in about April.
Of 45, yeah.
April towards May, that people were very cautious about calling down any fire on themselves if they could possibly avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody thought about it then. Boy, I hope I'm not the last casualty of this war.
Yeah, yeah.
Because by then it looked like it was, we were pretty...
Because mm-hmm. by that time of...
I know where my regiment were up north in Holland, northern Holland, not very far off the German border.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your... what you were doing at the time. You're at Nijmegen?
I know, I was just out of Nijmegen. At the monastery just out of Grave, Grave.
Mm-hmm.
And I was... put to work there to operate their transport section of this the reinforcement camp.
Yeah. Now you were wounded prior to this.
Oh yeah.
Now,
I was okay by that time. I was fine.
So where were you wounded?
Well, that particular time, once again, I got buried. Twice.
Yeah. Somebody had your number.
I think so. I don't know what they were trying to do. They were really trying to get me underground somehow. That's where it seemed to me I was spending a lot of time and being buried by these guys. And I got a lot. I had a lot of shock with it. I suppose more than anything else, it wasn't hurt that badly.
Yeah.
But so they kept me out. I also got pneumonia at the same time, which didn't help. That was a rough December up in that, out of Nijmegen, because it was snow and it was cold and wet and miserable, and we were getting a lot of guys coming down with, with flu and colds and
mm-hmm.
pneumonia, mm-hmm. I don't know what all. But anyhow, I didn't get back to the unit, and I was held there at this place, and when the war ended, I was handed about 150 German prisoners, and we rebuilt the place pretty well. Then, as a staging camp for bringing troops back through and over to England and home.
And you were with a transport?
Well, I was running their transport section for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you remember any problems or anything that sticks out of your...
Oh, yeah, we had problems. The only way I got out of there was demanding to be paraded to the brigadier.
Mm-hmm.
Had a major whose name I won't mention because there'd be no point in it. And he was black marketing.
Canadian?
Yeah. And at one point he asked me to take a truckload of gasoline down over the border into Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
He sent the work order down to me and I refused to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And he threatened to court-martial me for disobeying an order.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you sign the work order and I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to sign the work order.
Yeah.
And so we got in a pretty big hassle over it, and I asked to be paraded in front of the brigadier.
Now, paraded in front of the brigadier is, in other words, for what, having a meeting with?
Yes,
the
sir, brigadier. It
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
See, you have... You had, well, it was one of the rights you had in the services was asking to be paraded before your commanding officer or senior officer or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they just couldn't, if you wanted to do that, you there was no way they could legally stop you from doing
it. Oh, I see, yeah.
And I explained this to the brigadier, and he put me on the list to go back home right then.
Mm-hmm.
He said, carry on. He said, I'll make sure you get out of that place. And he said, if you don't, I'll have that guy's guts for garters at
mm-hmm.
that point. And he really tore a strip off this guy for this.
Now, what rank was this fellow?
He was a major.
Yeah.
I was captain.
Yeah. Was there a lot of black marketing? Or is this just an isolated incident?
I don't think there was that much.
Mm-hmm.
There was the usual, always had been, all the way through, the flogging of some blankets or some boots or whatever to civilians or
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this guy was doing it in the big way. I mean, he was starting to push gasoline out
mm-hmm.
to the civilians. It was obviously going to the market, the
mm-hmm.
black market there.
Was there a lot of money to be made?
Oh, yeah, if you could get it out again, I suppose. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. We had some amusing experience exactly as far as that. Quite a ways back in the war, one of our, couple of our guys, young privates, happened to knock over a German paymaster around the Sally area who was carrying a battalion payroll.
Of Dutch money?
No, this was in French money. That. And of course, the French had not changed their currency.
Mm-hmm.
And so our issue French money and the stuff the Germans were carrying was still more or less legal tender, I suppose you'd call it. But these kids were having ball, because what they were doing, in those days, a soldier could send back to his postal savings account in England X number of pounds per week or whatever it was. He could send this back. Well, these guys must have had everybody in the battalion sending postal notes back to their accounts. They'd give them a couple of thousand francs and say, would you, and then another couple of thousand to send back to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they racked up something close to 1,500 pounds or more apiece you know, before somebody twigged that there was an awful lot of activity at the divisional post office.
Yeah.
Money orders going
yeah.
out. You know. And so they made a snap inspection. Kid inspection and picked these guys off with all. I think all they had in their packs were toothpaste and the rest of it, their toothbrush and toothpaste, and the rest of it was money. So that was confiscated.
But it's one of those things where it spoils the war. What would you, I mean, if whether
oh, yeah.
it be money or anything else, what were you supposed to do with it?
I don't know.
Give it to the.
Just
the
gamble
camp,
it or
the
whatever,
camp.
I suppose.
Yeah.
The. It was actually this area you're talking about now, afterwards. I wasn't there, but it's been common knowledge in the battalion. When the war ended, they were up in the northern part of Holland,
mm-hmm.
and one of the smart privates was wandering around down along the canal, and there were all these barges were loaded barges, covered with tarp and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he was nosy, so he wanted to find out what was in these barges, whether it was just coal or what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be the ship's stores from the German luxury liner, the Bremen.
Mm, lovely.
She had made her maiden voyage from New York just at the outbreak of war in 39. And these were all, and I mean everything, all of the finest booze in the world. Everything, blankets, silverware, and all this booze.
Mm.
Well, our battalion quartermaster laid hands on all of this liquor, and it was in our quartermaster's stores, so that if anybody, regardless of rank, was going on leave, because some of the immediately were getting leave to England and so on, you could go and draw what you wanted to take with you on a quarter store. I did very well on that. And I'll have a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label and a few more of this and that, and away you'd go. And all the way up through the fighting, mostly any money we took off of prisoners was put into a fund in the battalion so that any time we ever stopped and you could get something, they'd find a couple of barrels of beer and buy them, you know, whatever. But we sort of had a an ammunition box full of various and sundry types of currency that could be used if necessary.
What about collecting of souvenirs? I don't know.
Oh.
This, that, and the other.
That was discouraged, really, particularly weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They really get tough when they sent you home about weapons, trying to get them back out.
Just that they didn't want people running
German
around.
German Lugers and the like, you know, didn't want them running around. I remember one very funny incident, actually. It was, I almost, they had a court of, almost, they were asking for a court of inquiry on it later, but on the way up to Falle, I was lying in the ditch along the road. There's always a stop and wait and go and stop and wait and go routine.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead company had run into some fire and they were working on it and we were just waiting. And along the road came this jeep and it was an American officer from headquarters. And of course, at that time, we didn't wear our rank.
Mm-hmm.
Officers was on tabs and we took it off and started in a pocket.
It's a delicious target.
They love to snipe at those things. So this American lieutenant got out of his jeep right opposite. I'm lying in a ditch having a rest. Opposite, and he said, "Say, boy, can you tell me where there would be some souvenirs?" And he was from Eisenhower's headquarters, this dude. And I said, "Well, there's if you just go up the road about a mile," I said, "there's an awful lot of them. You'll have to take them away from them, but there's a lot of souvenirs up there." And he got very mouthy. He said, "You realize who you are talking to, boy? I am Lieutenant so-and-so." So I got up out of the ditch and I took my three pips out of my pocket and waved at this fellow and said, "When you are speaking to a senior officer, you get out of your jeep and stand to attention and salute and say, 'Sir,' when you're talking to me, you see?" And I got a kid sitting there beside me with a grin on his face and he goes, with his Bren gun, and he says, "Now, sir?" I said, no, wait till you get him on the move. It'll be more sporting. Well, this guy turned around and took off at great speed. Much hilarity from the troops. And he didn't have a very good sense of humor, I guess, because he reported this, that he had been insulted by some Canadian thug up the line somewhere. And I got the word from the colonel. When we were moving up, he called me up into headquarters and said, "What is all this about?" He said, "I've got a directive from Eisenhower's headquarters that one of his staff officers or somebody had been given a very bad time by Canadians." So I told him what happened, and he laughed and shredded the papers up, and away we went.
And military relations between Canada and the States haven't the same sense. Speaking of American troops, did you ever have any run into any of them? I'm just wondering if you had formed any opinions.
No, not really. We were, we never were fighting very close to them. they were very good about equipment and stuff, giving it to you. I blew a connecting rod on a jeep outside of Antwerp, and a big black lorry driver from the United States towed me down to the harbor, to their quarters down there, the engineers' headquarters, and there must have been 5,000 Jeep engines sitting on the dock, anyhow, all stacked up in crates. And he said, "Fine, press on." He said, I actually had a bottle of whiskey in my bag, anyhow, so took it into the officer's mess there. And he said, "Oh, no problem." He said, "We put a new engine, we'll never miss one." And they did. They put a new engine in the Jeep. And I wondered what I had to sign, you know, for this, because if it had been the British or Canadian Army, you'd have signed your life away for a new engine. Anyhow, I drove it away. And after the war, of course, they're checking all the vehicles. And the MPs, because people were flogging anything, they were doing a lot of black marketing. And I had a terrible time explaining why my engine numbers did not coincide with the engine numbers on a plate on the Jeep that showed it. And nobody, and particularly the British MPs, wouldn't believe that somebody had given you a Jeep engine. I had a lot of problems with that.
Now, when the war is over, first of all, I guess, how did you hear about it?
How did I hear about it?
In May 45.
I had gone on leave out of this camp where I was dealing with a transport. I was in Ghent, in Belgium. When the war, when they announced VE Day. And then, of course, it was like everywhere else, I guess. Everybody went mad. It was a wild night.
Was there any skepticism? I mean, had there been rumors flying about?
Oh, yeah.
Now, all enemy activity would have pretty much
definitely
gone since for
died
quite
down
some
pretty
time.
Heavily there.
Did you ever hear about any incidences of people still fighting after the...
No.
No.
Not in that front.
Yeah.
There certainly wasn't. People were just, that was it. It was, and you know, the Germans were coming in droves, piles of equipment coming in.
What did they do with it all?
I don't know what they did with the German equipment. They must have destroyed it, I think, because, you know, Lord knows how many hundreds and hundreds of rifles and this sort of thing that came in when the Germans, when they surrendered. I don't know what they would have done with all that equipment. All our stuff was, before you went out of there, you moved it into a, and maybe it was the British ran them all, I don't know, but ours went into a dump that was being operated by the British. All the vehicles and that sort of thing you turned in before you went back to England.
Now, at what point were you sent back to England?
I was sent back to England in December. And almost directly onto the ship. We went right straight from onto the Queen Elizabeth.
So you were in...
I didn't have any, literally any stopover.
Yeah. So you were in what?
I was in
Europe,
in Europe until early December of 46, and then I was, well, it couldn't have been that early, because, well, it was before the before Christmas.
What were you doing there?
What, and I say I was still with this transport outfit till that. That's
oh,
when
I see.
Got
you still.
Stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Now. And you were, I guess, just wrapping up all the loose ends.
That's right.
Of,
well, we were moving troops, a lot of troops through there, you see. And I say this major was not very happy with me, of course, but and I at that time suspected he was trying to get me posted to a unit that was going to stay there. And I didn't have any point of that, so that's when we parted company.
I see. And then it was just more or less directly back to Canada.
I came straight back to, we came back to England. Matter of fact, we went all the way down, I guess, to Calais by train, across to Folkestone, back up by train to London, right through, because we went right straight through to Southampton. And the Mary and the Elizabeth were both docked at Southampton, and they loaded both ships.
And you landed in Halifax?
No, we landed in New York.
New York?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. And what trains up to?
Train across to Buffalo, and then onto the CN, and back home.
What were your impressions of Canada, having been out of country for 3 years?
You mean while I was traveling across it?
Yeah.
Not much. The troop train. It was colder than charity, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Because it went around the north end of Lake Superior, was cold, and it was about 35 below in Winnipeg on New Year's Eve. We stopped in Winnipeg for about a half hour, I suppose, and then home. I got home on January the 2nd, I guess.
And from there, were you discharged?
Discharged at Little Mountain Barracks in Vancouver, given the 30 days, disembarkation leave, and then when I came back from that, I was received my discharge.
And from there, what did you do? What kind of work did you do?
Well, after the war, when I finished, I went back and finished my last year at university, and then went out to the prairies for Imperial Oil, and worked there for about 10 years. And I decided that I wanted to work with kids. So I left Imperial Oil, went back to university, took an education degree and a master's and went to work teaching.
Is that right?
I'm retired now.
Yeah. So you did that from what, in the mid-50s?
I finished about 1960 when I went out to teach. I'm still working with the kids, actually. I do all the starting for track and field for the province.
Is that right?
All the starting for here in town, along with a couple of fellows I work with. But I'm the senior track and field starter in the province.
Is that right? So you must have been in all those meets up at the university.
Yeah, I did the meets at the university all the months of May and April, May and June. This week, of course, Tuesday, we were over for the I went over for the Harry Jerome Classic in Vancouver.
Yeah, excellent. Is there any topic that you'd like to discuss?
Just to say, it's been it was a long time ago. But it's funny. I guess maybe you do remember the funnier things now than the tragic things that occurred. Other than the fact that you go down now, I go down and on November the 11th ceremony and see all those old guys walking around down there, and I realize that there is me too. That we're all getting older.
Would you do it again?
Under the same circumstances, yes.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have enlisted in the Vietnam War.
No. Why was that?
I just don't think there was a cause. I still feel we had a reason. And the first concentration camp you saw.
There was definitely right versus wrong.
Somehow or other, there was a reason for it. It wasn't just done up by a bunch of politicians wanting a piece of the country somewhere.
What are your impressions of the Canadian forces today?
I'm sorry that they haven't got a lot of the things they need. I think we're falling into the same kind of a trap we were before World War II. I was out on one of the Navy ships a while back with the United Services Institute boys, and the ship was in, just spotless. The men were extremely well trained. The equipment, absolutely obsolete.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And it was obvious to you? Even
even I don't know anything about it. It was obvious to me how obsolete the equipment was. The weaponry alone is, you might as well take out a pea shooter. It's sad, I think, the force is doing other things, can do other things for us right now, too, as well as their primary, particularly the Navy, their primary role being submarine or anti-submarine. They can do a lot. They've been doing a lot of fisheries patrol, and certainly doing a lot of work in conjunction with the U.S. Navy. I don't know. I'm sorry to see the services sort of fall into disrepute in this way. We have, two Royal Roads and Royal Military College produce some absolutely top-flight engineering people and whatever. Any young man who is fortunate enough to go to get his education that way is a very definite asset to the country, I think.
Well, that just about wraps up, unless there's anything
Mark,
else.
Nothing as far as I'm concerned, and I really appreciate your taking the time. That was very good of you.
No problem. No problem whatsoever.